zero. It's your turn to grovel.
It's all good. Yeah, you
your
can.
Yeah, I just been waiting for you guys all day.
No, not me.
I was first here this morning.
All right, enough.
Hi,
good afternoon, everyone. This is the February 26, 2020 afternoon session of the Portland City Council.
Commissioner Udell.
There's Carla. Please call the roll.
Yes. Fritz. Hardesty.
Here.
Udaley.
Here.
Wheeler.
Here. And we only have a report today, so if you could just give the abbreviated version.
I will give the abbreviated version.
Be nice.
Welcome to Portland City Council. The council represents all Portlanders and meets to do the city's business. The presiding officer preserves order and decorum during city council meetings so everyone can feel welcome, comfortable, respected, and safe.
Exactly.
The presiding officer, we'll skip that part too. If you are in the audience and would like to show your support for something that is said, please feel free to do a thumbs up. If you want to express you do not support something, please feel free to do a thumbs down. Please remain seated in council chambers unless entering or exiting. If you are filming the proceedings, please do not use bright lights or disrupt the meeting. Disruptive conduct such as shouting or interrupting testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being ejected for the remainder of the meeting. After being ejected, a person who fails to leave the meeting is subject to arrest for trespass. Thank you for helping keep your fellow Portlanders feel welcome, comfortable, respected, and safe.
Very good. Please read item 171, Carla.
Accept report on the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability Zero Cities Project.
Colleagues, we know that we're in a climate crisis. In Portland, our carbon emissions have plateaued while the effects of a changing climate continue to worsen every year. Black, Indigenous, and communities of color feel these impacts first and worst. With carbon emissions and population on the rise, government action is no longer enough on its own. Everyone has to be part of the solution. All must benefit from the solutions created, and this work must be led by the communities who have been the most impacted by climate change. For the development of the city's 2015 Climate Action Plan, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability brought together an equity work group made of six community-based organizations representing the interests of low-income populations and communities of color. One of their key recommendations was to engage communities, especially impacted, underrepresented, and underserved populations in the development and implementation of climate change related policies. The Zero Cities Project is an example of the city delivering on that request. The Zero Cities Project centers the voices of Black, Indigenous, and communities of color by prioritizing policy that reflects lived experiences and addresses the realities of our racist history as a city and as a state. Often community processes can be tokenizing, are far from where the real decisions are actually made. I'm here to commit that this is not the case with the Zero Cities Initiative. The roadmap and policies developed through this process are the crux of the C40 Net Zero Carbon Buildings Declaration that I signed back in September of 2018. And that will inform the city's next climate policy decisions and implementation of our 100% renewable energy policy. We will hear a progress report on the Zero Cities Project from Vin Mason, Senior Energy Policy Advisor at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, as well as their invited panel of project partners that are co-creating a community-led engagement process for Portland's energy future. It's now my privilege to turn it over to Director Andrea Durbin from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to kick us off. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor. Good afternoon, Commissioners. I'm Andrea Durbin, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. We know our climate is in crisis. The impacts of this emergency are already here. We are no longer solving just for the future. We are solving for today. While Portland has and continues to be a champion for climate change, we know we must do more. And we know that the way to do this work needs to be different from the past. We need to deliver bold action that drives down carbon while centering the communities that continually are burdened worse by climate impacts and systemic racism. Because the truth is, climate change doesn't impact us all in the same way. Our frontline communities, including Portland's Black, Indigenous, and communities of color, are being hit first and worst by the impacts of the climate crisis. We can deliver better policies and programs that aggressively drive down emissions, build community resiliency, and ensure our frontline communities directly benefit from our actions. Carbon emissions from our homes and businesses are nearly equivalent to those from our transportation sector. Buildings and transportation are two of our top priorities for further climate action. The American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy conducted nationwide research that discovered nearly one-third of U.S. households are struggling to pay their energy bills. High energy bills can put a strain on families and lead to difficult trade-offs between paying energy and other necessities. Our households with lower incomes, communities of color, elderly households, renters, and multifamily housing residents tend to have higher energy burdens on average than other households. So how do we develop energy efficiency that significantly reduces that energy burden and results in improved health of the occupants and decreases carbon? That is the project we want to share with you today. Zero Cities was a pilot project to develop zero carbon roadmap for the building sector through a community-led engagement process that centers on equity and is informed by technical analysis. As our community partners in the city explore the intersection of racial equity and decarbonization of the building sector, we found that those who are most impacted by climate change are also the most informed to develop the solutions. This is a great example of the paradigm shift necessary to meet our climate goals while we lead with equity and prioritize community needs and benefits. You're going to hear about the project in greater detail, but this does not represent the end of this work. As part of our ongoing work plan and requested budget, we intend to build on this important community-led work to implement the policy recommendations they have prioritized. BPS has heard from you, our city's youth, and the communities that have been fighting for meaningful climate action that we need to do more to work with our frontline communities and our youth leaders. And this work needs to be resourced appropriately. The technical pathways to reduce our emissions are clear. Now we must actively resource the work to ensure the benefits of the implementation are just. I want to thank BPS staff Vin Mason for his hard work and commitment to this project, and I also want to thank Verde and our community partners for their participation and their continued leadership on this project and the next phase of Zero Cities. And I will turn it to the team to introduce the work that they've done.
Thank you, Director Durbin. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Andrea and Mayor Wheeler, and good afternoon, Commissioner Hardesty and Commissioner Udaly.
I'm going backwards.
My name is Vin Mason, and I work for the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. I'm joined by Oriana Manera from Verde, who is our lead community partner on this project. We are really excited to share a new approach to climate policy that centers on community-led engagement. We'll also hear from an invited panel of additional community partners at the end of this presentation. For over 12 years, I've worked on reducing the carbon footprint of Portland's buildings. Emissions from our homes and businesses, as Andrew noted, are nearly equivalent to those from our transportation sector. You can see in this pie chart that we have to address the building sector if we're going to get to our climate goals. This graph shows the percent change in our carbon emissions compared to 1990 levels. From 2000 to 2013, our carbon emissions dropped despite population and job growth. Since then, emissions have plateaued at best, as the mayor noted. From 2016 to 2017, residential emissions actually went up. They increased by 17%, while commercial emissions increased by 6%. To reach the city's climate action plan goals and 100% renewable energy goals, we need new climate action strategies as the severity of the climate crisis has become more apparent. So Mayor noted, BPS funded an equity working group to inform the city's 2015 Climate Action Plan update. About that same time, a new wave of activism emerged from our communities who are living on the front lines of climate change. On Earth Day 2017, the People's Climate March demanded climate justice and a just transition to a clean economy. I've been living in Portland since 1994, and I've gone to most of those Earth Day marches or rallies or events that have happened in town, the big ones, and this was the first time that I saw community organizations in the front, in the lead. It was really exciting. And at the same time, disconcerting, because that also means the impacts are being felt.
Me too, just so you know.
Yeah. Worldwide, we know that populations who are most impacted by climate change contribute the least amount of greenhouse gases. Locally, our communities of colors have had the least voice in developing policy solutions, despite being most vulnerable. But that's starting to change.
So it's one thing to be at the start of a march as a community-based organization, and it's another to actually start taking the lead in the work. And this happened in a significant way from my perspective when I was working at an organization called the Northwest Energy Coalition and was helping to plan an energy justice summit with community-based organizations there. I was a white staff member at a white-led organization trying to use capacity and information and help inform some of the work that occurred in this space. And now I've taken a role at Verde as the climate and energy policy coordinator, where I can help to apply that knowledge really effectively and really push from a justice-focused perspective. A little bit about the Energy Justice Summit is it was a space to share very technical knowledge about the differences between a decentralized and a centralized energy system and the need to move in that decentralized direction for more energy justice. It used participatory activities to help engage folks around this kind of really wonky technical information and had the goals of building transformational relationships, building a collective understanding around energy democracy and that decentralized energy system, and gaining familiar with the institutions that control energy resources and policy, the regulatory framework in the state, which is what I helped to contribute when I was in my former role. And then just building a framework for transformational community-based renewable energy resources, which is something that we need based on the commitments in the 100% renewables resolution, and then can put into practice through the resources that have come through the Portland Clean Energy Fund. This is the basis for a longer-term community-driven effort, and it's the start of work that is not just engagement-focused, because this was community drawing from good resources supported by the county, by funders to help put this summit together, but really leading and taking that technical knowledge and running with it in a meaningful way. And so as Verde, we hope to build off of that process, in particular because there is a participatory action research process, and I'll talk a little bit more about what that means later, that was not able to be undertaken. And we really wanted to take that and run with it with Zero Cities moving forward.
I was honored to also be part of the 2018 Energy Justice Summit, one of a handful of governmental employees to be there. And I just want to share that it was also really fun and engaging and informative. The team of community partners, including Verde, and many of the folks who are continue to be partners with us now, and their consultants, really created something special to get organized and figure out how to bring climate justice into empowering communities. About the same time as the Climate Justice Summit, BPS received funding to develop a zero-carbon building sector roadmap from the Urban Sustainability Directors Network, also known as USDN. Portland was one of 12 cities that was awarded the Zero Cities Project to prioritize policies that serve the twin goals of increasing racial equity and decarbonizing buildings by 2050. This includes community-led engagement funding passed through to a team of local community partners anchored by Verde. Our four other local climate justice champions were the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, the Coalition of Communities of Color, Opal Environmental Justice, and the Portland African American Leadership Forum. There was also consulting services provided by a USDN team of technical and equity consultants, including Architecture 2030, Movement Strategy Center, or MSC, New Buildings Institute, or NBI, and Race Forward. So I wanted to review a bit of the timeline of the project of when it started to where we are at today. So MSC, who is also the lead consultant for the Energy Justice Summit, kicked off the project for the 12 cities. And they started with a social ecosystem map. It was an understanding of what nonprofits and other organizations are out there that are leading on climate justice. They did, it must have been over 100 organizations that they heard about, contacted, did research on the websites. And where they landed was the same folks that organized the Energy Justice Summit and participated in it are also the same organizations that they're now recommending that lead the work for climate policy, such as the Zero Carbon Roadmap.
I'm sorry, who picked the partners? Say that again.
Oh, so it's Movement Strategy Center there out of Oakland. Yeah.
But I was like, mm-hmm. Who picked our partners? They did?
They recommended partners, hmm. Yeah, to each of the cities. And it was fortunate that I saw that the same folks who organized and participated in the Energy Justice Summit were also represented in their recommendations, though.
I didn't see the NAACP on that list, and they've been really active in that area, so just so you know.
Yeah, thank you. So then the next step was to build partnerships. This was at the same time as the Portland Clean Energy Fund gaining some steam, and a lot of campaigning was going on. So, of course, the same organizations that we're trying to recruit to be partners in this work are also leading that work. So it was a challenge to get onto the radar initially. And one thing I'll share there is it helped to have previous relationships, particularly with Verde and working with BPS. In my first meeting with Verde, with their executive director, and their, I'm trying to remember, Erie had this title then, but I think it was energy, it was overall policy coordinator, I believe. So their former staff person, we talked through a bit of the project, and there was some skepticism about what's the value proposition to the community. Is this something they would want to do? I heard that this sounds like a resolution within a resolution, like the Climate Action Plan, that might not have any teeth. And so I acknowledge that could be. But this is also teeing up our future work together and moving beyond resolution two and into future policy. I also share that I'm ready to embrace the unknown. I've been working with BPS and getting schooled on equity and what it means to have community leadership and the value in that. And part of that is letting go of the outcomes that we are seeking as the city. And so I think that resonated. I heard that resonated from Verde, that's something that they were willing to support. So I'll be highlighting some of the technical analysis, the roadmap of these next parts, and Oriana will be speaking from the community-led engagement piece. But after we established that, the recruitment of Verde as an anchor partner, and then the additional community partners, then a contract was set up between Verde directly with USDN, and they developed a scope of work that Oriana will cover more. But in summary, it's start with a curriculum, build capacity through an energy training session that happened in November, and then a community forum in December that was came out of the folks that participated in the energy training session. And then where we'll land is with a report on community-led engagement for Verde, from Verde, and then a roadmap that's informed by the technical analysis completed by Architecture 2030. We have a initial building stock assessment that was completed by Architecture 2030 that is a decarbonization analysis. So they created a model of energy consumption in all of Portland's building stock. This is the first time that we've done this. Prior to this, our data tends to be very high-level utility data at the residential sector, residential, commercial, industrial, one big number of kilowatt hours or therms of natural gas. But this gave us additional data on where we think we are today and where we think we're going in the future. So an example of that, if you look at, this is a little bit hard to read because of the small writing, but we're looking from 2000, it's even hard for me to read on here, is that 16?
Where's my reading glasses? 2060? Oh,
thank you. 2050 it should be, yeah. 2050. So 2017, 2015, we chose 2050 because of our 100% renewable energy goal. So we're looking at existing buildings slowly demolishing over time, and then the increase in new buildings based on the last 20 years of development and that growth rate. And what that tells us is in 2050, we really, if we're going to get to our goals for 2050, we have to focus on existing buildings. And that's where our focus should be first, because new buildings will be built slowly. One other thing I'll point to the right is this breakdown of multifamily and commercial and single family. And we can see that currently commercial buildings have the highest energy use, but multifamily has the largest projected growth.
Oh, that's interesting.
Another key piece that we have from the Architecture 2030 projections is carbon emissions. So similarly, 2017 to 2050, this is a business as usual scenario. So we start off and we're looking at what the utilities are giving to us for their projections for their greenhouse gas factors from their integrated resource plans. In about 2030, you can see the sharp decline in carbon emissions for both new construction and existing buildings. And the reason for that is the state's renewable portfolio standard and their coal to clean legislation. So after 2030 is the part that is the gap that we need to be concerned about in Portland, to bring that to zero. Mm-hmm. We need other policy interventions to close that gap and reach our 100% renewable energy goals.
When we talk about climate policy, the traditional framework is often very focused on emissions and in particular on carbon emissions. It leaves out the equity piece in terms of who benefits and who is burdened by different policies. One of the partners for the Zero Cities Project, one of the consultants at the national level, Race Forward, helped to bring an equity lens to the work by putting together an axis for assessing policy that balances both racial equity and not just equity, but naming it as racial equity versus carbon reductions. And that a successful policy will do both things meaningfully. They also pulled together a resource with some examples of arenas in which this work could play out, ranging from community engagement to addressing energy cost burden, which we'll talk more about later, talking about housing quality and exposure to health risks, which we'll also discuss, and then issues associated with just location and environmental risk, the results of histories of redlining and racist land use policy, and then also effects that come from that around urban heat islands.
In the work from Race Forward, they provided the number list originally and reordered it. Community engagement was at the bottom. We brought that to the top. In the initial meetings with our community partners, what I heard was we have to focus on displacement. You all have been hearing that too the last few years. Mm-hmm. And so our groundwork was to look at where is that intersection with displacement and climate change. So we started with the economic vulnerability analysis that BPS has prepared for the last few years. We're looking at identifying neighborhoods where people have the highest risk of displacement. And that's based on number of renter households, 80% MFI, median family income, number of people of color, and people without a four-year degree. And so we asked ourselves, where is that intersection with building decarbonization? And we thought of the energy bills, of course. And we looked at the research on energy cost burden. That's defined as 6% of income spent on energy utility bills. So we used US Department of Energy data to look at where are the neighborhoods that are the most energy cost burden for 60% MFI. And what we're seeing here, if you could flip back to the previous slide and forward again, we can see that the areas of Portland that are the most energy cost burden are also the areas that are at the highest risk of being displaced, or for many people, displaced a second or third time. So that was one of the connections that we made, that there are vulnerable populations that are on the edge of displacement or worse, and that it's the winter heating bill, I think especially, but this data is annual, and I want to point out that there's also some more work that we need to do in this area. We need to understand what the lived experience is too. This is just the conversation starter that we used for our curriculum.
Yeah, Commissioner Hurst.
You know, so we just had this conversation around RIP, right? Residential Infill Project. We absolutely know where displacement's gonna happen. There's no question about that. So when I hear you say we're gonna need to do some research and do some analysis, we know where the big apartment complexes are that people can't afford to live in and can't afford to move out of. So this is knowledge that's already exists. Mm-hmm. So I would be a little worried if we're gonna spend a lot of time reinventing the wheel when we already have this data. We know what's going on because we've actually been in dialogue and conversation with folks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree, and you're right. This is
so
really.
How do we take the information that we already know about? Because all this work is happening all simultaneously, right? So none of this is happening in a vacuum. I was hoping that we weren't starting from scratch; that we're actually starting from a place of we've got a lot of knowledge already. Mm-hmm. And how do we add value to that knowledge that we have?
So Commissioner Hardesty, I'm glad you raised that because I think that's a fundamental element of this project, of bringing both together what is the data that we have and kind of the basics that we have to go back to oftentimes in work as the city because we haven't done the work to really acknowledge what's happening. And oftentimes in policy work and program work, I think we also need to have things be proven in ways that like are known to community. So what we wanted to do with this process was to take what is known to community, the issue you're raising there, and synthesize it in ways that we can help make policy effectively and package it for policy and decision makers who are not necessarily as knowledgeable as yourself or aware of what's going on, so that we can really make that justification of here's the data that backs up community experience. And that's a little bit of a Trojan horse in a way, because it's a way to bring the community experience into policy making and kind of attach it to the data and eventually take those training wheels off so that we can just make policy from the experiences of community and what is known and trust that without having to say, well, you know, what do the experts say? What do consultants say? What does the map say? And really just take for fact and for truth what is happening and what communities in Portland and the metro area and across the country and the world know to be true.
Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that, because, you know, the city is really good at adopting language, right? Mm-hmm. We do that very, very well. What we're not good at is actually changing the outcomes for communities who have been who have not experienced the wealth that Portland has to offer, right? So I'm a little concerned, because I know there's at least four budget requests around anti-displacement. And so, I'm concerned that everybody has the right words and everybody will be talking the same language, but most people don't know what the heck they're talking about when they're using those words, right? What does it look like in action? Because I know my colleagues and I are not going to fund four different projects that are around displacement, right? So I'm concerned that people are adopting language without mm-hmm. adopting action that actually leads to new outcomes. So, mm-hmm. on the record, just wanted it to be there. We'll keep having the conversation.
Thank you.
And just to jump back in, Commissioner Hardesty, I think that's a very fair concern, but to do a little bit of BPS's work for them, I would like to plug the budget work that they're putting on the table, because I think it is really grounded in community, and despite having to make some significant cutbacks on both the sustainability and anti-displacement side, I think BPS is still very committed, and I would encourage council to fully fund that work, if not think more about what are other bureaus doing and who's actually putting their money where their mouth is. And
well, I think they have to make
here.
Their case like every other bureau.
Agreed.
But what I will hope is what they show up us is better than other proposals that we will be considering, right? I it's way too premature for me to make any commitments to anybody about any budget dollars at all, right? So I want to be really clear about that. But I love the work that BPS has been doing, because it's been very intentional. I love the fact that they created the book around racist housing policies as actually being used as a model for how we not repeat the past, right, and do things differently. But I also think that it's a little challenging for us at the city to really think outside of the bureau we work in, it's like, okay, so who's doing anti-displacement? We should have everybody who's doing anti-displacement working together on an anti-displacement plan. We don't need 10 anti-displacement plans, right? So that's the thing, right? So thank you. I mean, I'm excited about this, because I know the work that BPS has been involved in, and I know where they're headed. But I just get a little crazed when we have outside folks picking people to lead work that then's going to lead to a budget ask, and then we haven't connected the dots internally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, to build on that was good, because Andrea's over there laughing, because I had this conversation with her a week ago. But slightly different take, actually. So it dovetails nicely with what you were saying, and my question really was, okay, given the budget forecast that we had previously, there's no new ongoing and highly limited one time.
Right.
So if we do not have the dollars, does that mean we're going to do nothing around anti-displacement? Because that's not an acceptable answer either. So I think the question isn't just taking the good work that the Zero Cities folks are doing, the collaborative here, but also asking our bureaus, how do we integrate anti-displacement into the thinking we do around planning and development and not make it an add-on? Because currently it's still viewed systematically as an add-on.
Yes.
And I'm just thinking ahead to what happens in recessionary times. Does that mean no anti-displacement? I just don't think that's an answer we can live with.
I agree. I think we got a lot of work to do internally, but it's hard.
Yep.
This is good.
And it is timely, because the spring bump is coming up, and we'll be asking for some additional dollars for the project to dig deeper into energy cost burden not in national research, but the actual lived experience, and also helping folks understand their utility bills so that as an educational experience.
So how much money did we get from joining this national effort?
Including the consultant amount is estimated about $500,000 per city, but the pass-through to our community partners was $47,500.
Say that again. $47,500 was passed through to community partners?
Yeah, and BPS didn't receive any actual funding to our bureau. But we received consulting services.
Where did the other money go?
Consultants to the project. Yeah. So Race Forward, that's developed the tool that we use.
What a great deal.
So Commissioner Hardesty, I think something, I appreciate that you raised that, because it came up with community and that question of why can't community be paid at the same rate consultants are. And so we leveraged extra money. We were initially quoted, I think, $25,000, and we said we can't do community work for that amount. Okay. And then leveraged an additional $7,000 from the generous contributions of the county and an additional $7,000, so that's $14,000 on top of the $47,500 to value community members, not fully for their time. We would love to pay them, you know, the hundreds of dollars an hour that consultants make, but to at least give folks the rate that I make when we do our grant making and value people for their time. So I think that's important. And to the budgeting issue, the money needs to go where community is. Yes. And as you look at the budget, I don't want to sidetrack us too much into that conversation, but I'm also a lobbyist, so I'm going to lobby. But to make sure that that money is going where community is and where bureaus are investing in community, like you can look outside your bureau and see where is that commitment happening, mm-hmm. where is the money getting out of the bureau and into community and valuing folks for their time so they can bring that expertise and we can make policy and programs that are truly meaningful and actually address concerns that are coming up for community rather than kind of spinning our wheels a little bit the way we tend to do.
Yeah, it's a good point.
And I see that the county is here today, too, and I wanted to thank them for quadrupling the stipend for participation in the community forum that you'll hear about shortly. But back to the curriculum and then leading to the training session.
Yeah, so I'm glad we had that discussion because I think the resources is a really key piece of what we're doing. And as Verde pulled our scope together, we wanted to do things a little bit differently. We didn't want to do community engagement. We wanted to do community organizing and really focus not just on bringing folks to the table and asking them how they feel about things and maybe a little bit about their experience and then going and putting it in a black box the way things often work and then putting something out that was already predetermined as a decision where there's no ability to influence decision making. And say, we're not going to do that. We're actually going to do some organizing, and we're going to build some power, both figuratively and literally, through this work in a way that is actually meaningful and impactful and allows folks to influence the decisions that come out of the process. So our initial hope is that there is some policy that will come out the other end in the form of a resolution or an ordinance around building performance standards that will reflect the work that happens here. Because another problem that often comes up in community engagement work is that it starts, it happens, and then nothing happens after that. Community is not re-engaged. There's no sense of what happened with the information that was provided. Folks don't have ownership over their data, and there's no way to really influence the work as it continues to go forward. And our commitment as Verde, as an organization, both to our partners that we worked with and the community members who participated and the forum participants more broadly, is to make sure that we are bringing that along in a way that is meaningful and creates a new way for policy to be developed. So our model was to start with a training to help build capacity around buildings and energy, and the values you see up on the screen right now are what we wanted to bring to that space. They're very similar to the Energy Justice Summit, developing relationships across communities, building a collective understanding of how energy impacts planning and building design, defining what building is, and recognizing that sometimes we think about it truly as a box and not necessarily how folks interact with a building in terms of transportation or community gardening or many other things that are outside of the building that folks feel as their relationship to a building. And also redefining net zero, which is a term that doesn't mean an awful lot to a lot of folks, and really thinking about what is it, what is the zero we're trying to achieve? Is it just zero carbon emissions, or are we actually talking about harm to community, and in particular harm to Black, Indigenous, and other communities of color? And then, like the Energy Justice Summit, just gaining familiar with some of the technical knowledge and institutions that come to play. So then we instigated a participatory action research process with about 12 members who participated in the training. The training had about 20 folks, and both the training, the participatory action research process, and the resulting forum were all bilingual spaces, which significantly increased the amount of resources that we need. Doing community work is already expensive when you add on actually feeding people, providing childcare, but then when you're actually trying to engage folks with different linguistic backgrounds, that adds to that that need significantly. So what participatory action research is it takes the idea that oftentimes community is something that is studied and is kind of put underneath a magnifying glass or under a microscope. And we can flip that and allow community to set the questions that define the research, to do the research work and recognize that they're experts in their own experiences and experts in building relationships with other community members, and build off that to develop data that comes from community rather than, you know, some data set that we pull from the national level or something that's kind of built in a lab effectively and is really removed from the lived experiences. So participatory action research allows people to define what problems they face in their community, to help drive the direction of a process or drive direction of policy, and find out what the solutions should be based on that experience and based on needs and opportunities, and then implementing those solutions. Again, going back to the, this has to actually go somewhere that is meaningful for this process to be happening in the right way. If we stop at any point and don't actually follow through on making some sort of policy or program happen that was developed by community, in Verde's mind, we've failed to do this work. So we're really committed to fight to ensure that we get something meaningful out of this process.
And how do you keep governments involved so you're not coming back at the end saying, okay, so we spent 2 years doing this process and here you are, the community wants X, Y, Z, do it. How do you, what's going to be the process? Have you envisioned how you keep folks that actually have to fund your ideas in the loop while the process is happening?
I think that's a really great question, Commissioner Hardesty, and I think that comes from the way that other stakeholders do that work, which is coming and talking to folks. Our hope is that as we get into the development around what comes out of this, that we have the opportunity not only for folks to testify today, but to resource people to come and speak to commissioners directly about the process as it develops and actually think about, you know, the ways that industry often has capacity to come and inform decisions by being able to pay folks to come and meet, or that community-based organizations like mine can do so, albeit in perhaps less of the same capacity, but really make sure that folks are able to help move policy and build those connections with decision makers so that it doesn't seem like it comes out of left field,
right,
or that you fund something. The other opportunity is you can always call us back for more progress reports. We're happy to keep talking to you about this work because it's important.
I can tell you that I actually have no free minutes on the day to say, oh, I wonder what I need more info on, right? I think it's to be proactive, either invite us to come to a meeting so that you can do a presentation for us and we can have a give and take. But I would be very concerned about, you know, you coming back when you've completed your work. And I look at the mayor, and the mayor look at me, and we say, well, we made funding decisions for this year. Come back next year, right? I hope you'll also make sure that the work group understands all the government's funding mechanisms and processes so that we're making realistic requests, and we're not coming in, right, trying to redesign how city government operates, right? So, because it has to be a two-way street, right? Mm-hmm. And as you know, as a former community organizer, as a still a community organizer, what do I mean former? You're never a former community organizer. That's Obama, right? But as a community organizer, I understand that it has, the education has to work both ways. Mm-hmm. And it has to be continuous, right? Because you want to bring us along while you're bringing community along as well.
Thank you for noting that, Commissioner Hardesty. We would love to have you and Mayor Wheeler and Commissioner Udaly and Commissioner Fritz come and participate with community, because that's been a request that has come up that I think due to some scheduling issues in the fall never fully came through given the amount that council had on its plate then, but would love to have the opportunity for that two-way street to happen, because that's how meaningful policy occurs, is when you can remove the barriers, remove this desk and that dais that are between community and you, and make policy co-creatively. Like, that's what we're trying to get at. So I'm excited to hear that you have that excitement as well.
Brianna, could I ask you a question? When you use this process, the participatory action research, how would you expect the outcomes to differ from, say, the status quo way we approach things?
That's a great question, and we'll talk about that a little bit more as we talk through the process, but I think just as a note to start, despite the good intentions of a lot of folks who do planning or sustainability work, in particular when they're white folks doing the work and white folks who come from privilege, there is a lack of knowledge and just no ability to understand an experience despite a lot of empathy and the amount of reading and work you can do on your white privilege and white supremacy, but that doesn't equate to the same as actually having community experience lead with policy. And we need more people working in places like the Bureau of Planet and Sustainability who have lived experience, but we also need to break down those barriers and recognize that even like once you go through a degree program, there's some separation in terms of this is the way planning works or this is the way environmental science works that's divorced from the realities. And I see that a lot. I do a lot of regulatory work and policy work at the state level in energy, and you see that disconnect even with people who have lived experience sometimes because it's so far removed in these, again, spaces that are so insulated. We need to break down those barriers effectively because we get results that are more true to what is happening and are going to be more effective because they're drawn from what is actually the problem at hand and how do we solve it, and sometimes also saying how do we solve it in a way that's really radical, because the other thing that's really different is oftentimes when we're working within existing frameworks, we're going to stay within those frameworks and maybe we'll push the bounds a little bit, but more often than not, we're going to stay in that box. Just in the way we wanted to redefine building in this process, we're trying to explode that idea of what are the frameworks we use to build policy and reinvent it.
It seems for it to be successful, there also has to be an underlying trust, right, between both the government institution that is, quote, sponsoring the process and the process that's being run by the community. Because I could see one real hang-up being that the community engages, the community takes the time, the community establishes priorities, the community, based on lived experience, then makes recommendations, and then it comes back to government. There has to be an agreement really in advance that the government body would accept the findings, the priorities, and the recommendations of the committee, right? I mean, doesn't that have to be sort of the agreed-upon approach?
Mayor Wheeler, I think the trust is really important, and that's an issue that was raised by community members, that we had to build trust at the training, and there's a little bit of distrust for this process because folks are used to things working in that community engagement way that often doesn't have meaningful impact. And so there's a sense of, like, what are you actually trying to do here? Like, you know, a distrust of what's being open. And I think that distrust should still exist because we haven't followed through on that. And I just want to call back the commitment you made in your opening remarks and thank you for that commitment to this work, because that's how trust gets built, is follow through from decision makers, that commitments aren't made in empty ways, and that we actually are, when we start something like this that's really significant work, we continue to resource it, we continue to do it, and then we don't just move on to the next thing because we have new language. We're not talking about anti-displacement anymore because we're talking about some new shiny thing that we're worried about, you know, as white folks, because we're like, oh God, there's more white supremacy that we have to deal with over here. You know, what shape does it have? But really making sure that we're not leaving things behind, and when we make a commitment, that that commitment is sustained and that we are coming back to it and not moving on.
Yeah, and you made a good point earlier that's now starting to connect with me, and that is the trust really has to result from ownership. It's the ownership that maybe is the biggest difference here, the community ownership.
Yeah. And I also just want to say that trust is really important because we had good partners in the work. I can't say enough about how hard Vin has worked on this project, how well he has shown up and just committed and followed through when things kind of went in new directions. And it's having people like Vin on these kinds of projects that helps to build the trust, and like the internal advocacy that Vin did as well to help make sure we were resourced and that this work was moving forward. Like, when you have, again, staff members who have lived experience that they can bring to the table, that helps build trust, not just in the relationship, but then in the commitment.
Thank you. And Vin, thank you for making us all look good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, let's go into the community forum.
Thank
Remember
you.
The action happened.
Yeah. Yeah, this has been a great discussion, by the way. Thank
yes,
you
thank
all
you.
For the wonderful questions. So after the training, the participatory action research process, where we developed our research questions, figured out what we wanted to share, built some participatory activities that folks could use to engage with the content, we had a community forum on the 14th of December of last year. And we hosted at the June Key Delta Center, recognizing that this is a net zero building, so it's an example of where we're trying to go with this work, but also a community center and a space that does a lot of good work for the community, and also grounding it in that as well, not just going to any net zero building, but one that could really hold the values that we are trying to create in this space. And as part of the forum, we addressed different stations, which we'll talk about, where we kind of gathered our data, addressing the displacement issues and going beyond just like, oh, this is a problem we have, but how do we actually, how is it being experienced? What can we learn here? And what can we draw from in a meaningful way?
And when, okay.
How long is this Zero Cities? How long is the process?
So it was about a year to get to the forum. A lot of it was kind of just initial engagement and a little bit of a slow start. From the training to the forum itself, it was about a month of work. And then now we're probably in about 6 months of continuation. Right now, Verde is seeking out resources from funders outside of the city to help continue and resource that work, because we don't want to ask community members to do anything that isn't paid and not valued for their time. We've had additional commitments from the U.S. Sustainability Directors Network, who funded Zero Cities, and the city is also seeking some money within the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to support the work as well. So we're confident we'll be able to continue to fund it and continue this moving forward. There are also opportunities to braid the work with other projects.
To do what?
To braid the work with other projects, because the idea here is not just to do this one-off and have Zero Cities be like a discrete thing, but how do we build a community of practice? How do we address policy around equity mapping or energy supply or a number of different areas in this way? How do we build off of the energy, which Finn will talk a little bit about, that came out of the forum, and the engagement of folks so that we don't just have a discrete participatory action research team doing this work, but how do we keep growing it in the way that as an organizer, you kind of grow the onion of building a movement?
So I am cautiously optimistic, right? Because here's what I know. We have a new climate emergency resolution coming back to the city council. I didn't see anything about Zero Cities in that. We have a budget process that starts in March, and we will have completed it by June. Haven't seen anything in there about that. So I just want to be straightforward, especially with community members in the room. I'm feeling a little anxious because I feel like this is my first opportunity to hear about Zero Cities. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing good stuff, but I'm not hearing how it feeds into the work that the city is doing right now today, right? That resolution is coming next month.
Commissioner, if I could suggest at the end, maybe at the end of the presentation, Director Durbin, if you could come up and answer that question, because I know she has an answer for that question. Good, thank you. But I don't want to interrupt the flow of what we've got here.
It's a happy answer, though, but thank you for bringing
it
up. So I wanted to describe a little bit.
That's very good.
So I was making sure it's in there. So I want to describe a little bit of experience at the forum, and first starting just with the space itself, the June Key Delta Community Center on Albina and Ainsworth. So that will likely be the first commercial net zero energy building in Portland. It will be very exciting. I think to have a place of that leadership coming from community to seek the highest level of green building or sustainability in a building was amazing. And I wanted to acknowledge Chris Poole Jones, the late Chris Poole Jones, who was the champion of that work, and how much I enjoyed working with her in the 2000s and early 2010s as that project was developed. And I could not think of a better place to have our community forum. Before we get into the stations that Oriana was referring to, where the action really happened, there was a time just settling in together, and the first question in a group of over 50 people in the room with myself and Tony Lamb, who works for the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and who did the energy cost per analysis for us. Thank you, Tony. And Knowledge Murphy, who's here now, and wasn't with the county at the time, but we were like the very small amount of folks from government there. And the question was, what was your experience with the city previously? Pair up. We're all in this group. And so I'm looking around. I couldn't find anybody who wanted to talk to me. I would introduce them from the city, you know. I saw a group of three people. And so I walked up to one of the folks and said, I see your group of three. Can I talk to you? And she was like, I don't know if I want to talk to you. So it was like, what's your experience with the city? Not so good. Mm-hmm. And went to one community meeting. She lived out in her 122nd division. And in that community meeting, shared the input and felt like it went nowhere, and that this very tokenized by the experience. And so I asked that be open to today, what's going to happen, and I hope that she has a very different experience. And from my perspective, it was very, very different than any other engagement, which I'll share a little more on later. But another thing I want to highlight is what we did is a snowball fight, where this is also coming from the work that was done with Movement Strategy Center and their team of consultants for the Energy Justice Summit, where a question that you might have is written onto a post-it, you crumple it up, throw it into the middle, and then you go in and pull out somebody else's question, organized by the other person's question, and then start talking about it. And so there's maybe six or seven groups that develop out of that, talking about the questions, and then working off community wisdom on that. For instance, Knowledge Murphy, who's here, has a depth of knowledge around renewable energy and energy efficiency. He recently moved here from Pittsburgh, and one of the other leading cities, as we know from Mayor Podesta, and on climate change and equity. And he just had all this wealth of knowledge to share. And it was amazing to see the interaction of between people rather than experts saying this is how it's done or government saying, like, this is how we're going to do it. So that was the highlight that I really wanted to share.
Thank you.
So one of the things that came out of the forum was a conversation about values. And you see in the picture on the screen right now what was designed as a tree, which looked at a few different elements. The roots being the values that we hold, blue and purple stickies kind of on the trunk being opportunities and challenges, and then the leaves at the top being things that people would want the city to know or how they would want to see change happen, growing from those roots and through those challenges and opportunities. And as part of our data analysis, when we were looking through these stickies and organizing them and figuring out what the results were, Antoinette and Derek, who are behind me, were working as part of that group, so thank you for that, and came up with three really key themes values that they wish the city held. One was repairing broken trust, and I think, Commissioner Hardesty, you've touched on a lot of that, and in particular in raising that, like, well, what happens? Does this work continue? That distrust of, like, you can say really good things, and you can put up community members, and they can talk about their experience, but if there's not that follow-through, there's not that commitment, that trust never gets rebuilt, an issue that Mayor Wheeler raised as well. Then listening, that issue of actually coming together and having decision makers and community talking throughout a process instead of having a black box where we come at the start and say, hey, we're going to do this, it happens, then we come out the other end with a resolution, and there's been no opportunity to build trust through listening, and then practicing, actually putting that work in place, not just in the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and in the hands of staff members who understand and hold these values, but in every bureau in this city and through all of our policy work. If we put that into practice, that's how we start to repair. That's how we create the opportunities to listen in a meaningful way. And then we, as I said, organized the forum first through activities of kind of building relationship and generating questions and starting conversation. The culmination of the day was the research questions that we had developed, and they could be organized into four themes. One was the question of energy cost burden and the experiences that folks had paying their bills or heating and cooling in the summer, of air quality when fires came up, and how air conditioning can affect whether you can close your window and not breathe in that really toxic air. Then anti-displacement and affordable housing. We had a focus group where folks could talk about their experiences and move beyond just that. We know where it's happening in a discrete way, but like, what is actually the experience of that for folks who've been displaced 2-3 times and are at risk of being displaced again? We found in that space that people really value non-traditional ways of living, that people want to see living situations that can more reflect the relationship building that is really important to the folks who participated in this space. And think about home us individually and more collectively. And I think we can perhaps extend that to extrapolate a little bit to our land use policy as well and think more collectively about how we're holding that space in ways that can actually help to facilitate community and are a little bit less discreet and a little bit less extractive. We also talked about community-based renewable energy, which is something that remains undefined in the 100% renewables resolution. We did some kind of free writing to help come up with definitions and are currently continuing to analyze that to figure out what does community want out of community-based renewable energy. We also did a dot activity about where a project could be located and still be called community. You know, does it have to be on your home or your street? Does it have to be located in your community or neighborhood, in the same city, county, and kind of going progressively out? The results of that were overwhelming, and you can perhaps guess what they are, but people want projects located in their communities, a place that they can bike or take the bus to or walk to, whatever their mobility is, to have a relationship to that project. If it's located hundreds of miles away, at least based on the data we collected in this space, it's not a community project, even if it has that ownership. So I think that's a really important thing for us to take away as we start to think about what Portland Clean Energy Fund projects look like, how we meet our 100% renewable energy goals. Are we really investing in projects that have a tangible connection to community and are not just connected to the grid at large? And I'll let Vin finish out with the final activity.
Yeah, so the last one's the Policy Solutions Lab, where we set up a mock city council hearing. We had Mayor J.R. Singh from Pano lead that, and that was council staff. And everybody cycled through and gave us information and ideas and solutions on the split incentive. So the split incentive in the energy world is what has boggled the world over on rental properties, where the renters pay the bills, but the owner owns the property and doesn't pay the bills, doesn't make the energy investment. As the building falls apart, or maybe it was never constructed correctly in the first place, the renter's paying higher utility bills than they should be. So out of that, we framed the issue around the split incentive and then started asking folks, like, what are your solutions? And they could either, actually everybody submitted a written comment on a post-it of their solution idea, but also prepared testimony for it to us. What we heard loud and resoundingly were these three pieces that all kind of go hand in hand together. So first, that there should be minimum energy efficiency standards for rental properties to help reduce the utility bills. The challenge there is if there's an investment into energy efficiency, then that shouldn't be passed on in rent, as would normally happen. So stable rent is the other thing that we heard. So thinking about how does a landlord in their position not pass on the cost to the rental or renter? And so there needs to be some incentives to invest in clean energy without burdening renters. Then those incentives may be going to the landlords or to the renters. So that's the...
On that particular point, is there any national data about how you can incentivize the landlord and not kick out all the people who've been living in the substandard apartments after you've gone in and done energy efficiency improvements? Right? Because even if there's like no lowering of the rent, if your utility bill goes down, I live in a place that's not considered a low-income building, but I can tell you if you stand in front of my window in the wintertime, you can feel the wind blowing in without having to open a door or a window or anything, which means that my bills in the winter are like $150+, and it's just me, right? So I would hate to actually do energy efficiency improvements in my apartment complex and have my rent go up and then get kicked out because they mm-hmm. want somebody that's going to pay more, right?
Right.
So is there any data where it's been successfully implemented and did not harm the people that were supposed to be helped?
I think that is for our next step to research that more. I don't know that right now. I know there's programs like Multnomah County has a weatherization program that's tied to rent control too, but because of the rent control
buildings. I mean, that's in the Section 8 buildings, right? That we have it now, and the Oregon, the Energy Trust of Oregon mm-hmm. supposedly provides those incentives for new housing that's going to be built. That's actually rent stabilized. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what else is out there right now.
My understanding, though, is that the county's weatherization program doesn't have a high uptake in its use because of rent control, though. And so we need to somehow solve for that, too. And minimum energy efficiency standards could be a way to actually require it versus to have a voluntary program. And that's something that we've seen in New York City and Washington, D.C. now. I'm actually going to Washington, D.C. in 2 weeks to meet with 10 other cities, with those two cities, to figure out how did they do it. They're actually looking to us for advice on how to do community engagement around it because they felt like they didn't do that very well.
They're looking for advice from us?
Yeah.
I know. Thank you.
It's amazing. It's all relative, right? Okay, so on to some lessons learned on the city side. One is connecting with new people. So we've established relationships that are, I think, are just getting stronger and stronger with the climate justice organizations that are our partners. But we haven't reached much further beyond those relationships or those organizations. And so this was an opportunity to do that. At the community forum, Sam Barrasso came out, the Portland Clean Energy Fund manager, and he said, wow, I don't recognize anybody here. And Sam is very well connected.
Yes.
And so that was exciting. It's like, that's a good thing. And he recognized that. That's a really good thing, too. We're reaching folks that wouldn't normally come out and be part of a policy process. The next thing, building trust, is really about letting go of outcomes. And for myself, there were points where I had to personally just think, reprogram my mind to let go of those outcomes. And at times I voiced them, and I had to step back and show some humility and apologize for that. And I think that also helps build trust, too, as to be aware of the value. And trusting community is also them trusting us. The other thing that I thought was really interesting was technical expertise. So prior to the city, I was working in the community with nonprofits, and it was often very seamless in working across nonprofits. And NBI, who is one of the consultants of the project, is also a nonprofit that's local-based. Amy Cortese, who's here today, came out to one of our PAR team meetings. And I loved seeing the immediate trust that happened. It's almost like you have to unearn trust between nonprofits when you first meet. And that was just wonderful to see. And the amount of knowledge that was transferred there that just can't come from the city because of our history of racism as an institution. And so I would definitely recommend bringing in that consultant in that role, which is probably more limited than the overall project design, but in some role. Then lived experience, what you mentioned about being removed from lived experience, it really resonated because through most of my 30s, before I was doing equity work, I was mostly doing sustainability work, and I did get removed from that experience. I come from poverty, I'm mixed race, Vietnamese, and rural Appalachian, deep poverty on both sides, and I was fortunate to have the opportunities to move out of poverty, and I think there was some distance in there. And as I started going on the equity journey through BPS and other places, it has started to transform who I am as a person. And then when I go through the lived experiences of hearing where other folks are at today that are in that same poverty that I lived through, I immediately know what that's like. And so having that lived experience to learn from community, but as you mentioned, I think also to have staff that know that lived experience. Bilingual conversation, which is also part of the Energy Justice Summit, and to have like folks in their native language, in this case, we provided Spanish translation, it's a different type of conversation. And we had that in multiple places. At times, it didn't always work out because of budget or scheduling, and there's definitely some challenges around there for consistently every week to have bilingual conversation for every small group table. But where we had it was tremendous. And I thank Oriana for making that a priority in our work. Something else we heard from the PAR team, and it was a decision fairly last minute, and maybe some other folks will speak to that are here today, was let's make this a black and brown space at the community forum. And that was a key decision. That was what I heard was that there's been enough whiteness at this table, and I agree with that. And so let's do this without other folks that don't have the experience of being a person of color in the room. I really appreciated that was how we move forward, and because that certainly has not happened in my experience at the City of Portland for policy decision making. The last thing I wanted to point to here is the invitations from our PAR team, and wanted to acknowledge Taryn and Derek and Anjanette that you'll hear from shortly, and also Donovan, who's here at council, that they sent out these invitations about 2 weeks in advance for a Saturday in the holiday season. And all my work at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, we're told, don't even plan around the holiday season.
Right.
Don't put it on a Saturday. Right. You know, all the things, all the don'ts were almost the opposite. Again, back to trusting the process. And it was amazing how many folks that came out because the invitations came from the network of people. And this is the ownership. And when the city just comes out and says, hey, come on down to our process, or we'll come out to you, it's still the city's voice. Right. And this is a process that the community owned and we were a partner in. So those are my lessons learned here. Think about next steps then. So Verde will produce a community engagement report that is then a model for USDN, but also for other policies in Portland as we move forward.
And so what is the expectation when Verde creates this report? What happens to it?
So that report, already the findings from that report we've shared with you today, we are already advancing next, which I'll go right into. But then the report becomes a basis that we can refer back to and question ourselves, are we actually still on track as we move forward with this work? And so advancing Zero Cities to the next steps.
And I think, like, perhaps reading into that question a little bit, there's, like, the report to funders, which is a deliverable that we have and something that the city will use, but that there's also how we engage community going forward with the data, and that's something we've just completed our data analysis a couple weeks ago. We now have a little bit of extra money to continue the process. The participatory action research team will be deciding, like, how do we want to distribute that? How much do we want to focus on policy development? How much do we want to focus on re-engaging forum participants and sharing the data and creating ownership? Like, who are our audiences for reporting is really important, because yes. I think sometimes in this work you're like, okay, I have to do a report. It's going to the funder, it's going to be in this language and this form, and not also thinking about how do I report back to the people who gave their time to this process and gave their expertise.
So this is actually a great discussion, and I just want to note it's been so good that we've gone way over our time, and I don't want to lose our quorum, and we've got a couple of people who want to present that we wanted to hear an answer to the question that was asked by Commissioner Hardesty from the director.
Let's wrap up quickly then. So Architecture 2030 will do a further analysis based on the recommendations of the community forum, and that combined with Verde's work will be a roadmap that gets Portland on track to a fossil-free building sector by 2050 while prioritizing the concerns of our communities of color. So we start with minimum energy efficiency standards for rental properties. We've already received national funding from Institute of Market Transformation and the National Resources Defense Council to continue the Zero Cities model, to continue the community engagement and the creation of minimum building performance standards, starting with rental properties. Real quick on the what if we didn't start with community-led engagement, we could have moved, let's say, to building performance standards as New York and Washington D.C. has done, and then have those investments be passed through in rent, increase displacement of those who have already been displaced before, too. And that's the unintended consequence that we are planning to avoid through a project like this. So would you like to, anything closing before we invite out our panel?
I don't think I have anything to add. I think the most important thing today is to actually hear from the folks who participated in that process and, again, start to remove those barriers between decision makers and communities in this work.
Great. Thank you. Excellent report.
Thank you.
Terrific conversation. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Oriana, too, for the work that she's committed to do. That was shared today.
Sound like a community organizer now.
Great. Come on up. We have an invited panel. I'm afraid I don't have the names, do I? Oh, I do. No, I don't. This is from the last one. Could you all introduce yourselves before you speak for the record? Thank you.
Hello, my name is Derek Thompson.
Hi, Derek.
Hi, Derek. Jose Golaskis.
Nice to meet you.
Engineer Brown.
Good to see you.
And Taryn Evans.
Good to see you.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks for having us here today and letting us speak. My name is Derek Thompson. I'm the executive director of Five Star Goods, and we're a nonprofit organization where we mentor young adults through employment and wellness. Along with my business partner, Bredo, we work with young adults, a lot of high-risk youngsters, to create employment opportunities for these youngsters and prepare them for different work skills and things like that. So when we heard about the PSELF grant, we thought it was a way for us to get some of our youngsters involved in the clean energy field. And so after networking from some of those meetings, you know, we were invited to the Zero Cities sessions. And so once we got to those sessions, really for me, I started to learn a lot myself about things that I never even thought about, things, you know, that I never even would have even paid attention to as far as the clean energy and things. So for us to want to get our kids involved in this, it was just something like, wow, well, we need to learn more about it ourselves. And then to that, it's just like, wow, so if, you know, it was for people like me that didn't even think about clean energy or energy buildings or emissions and things like that, how many more of those are out there like that that, you know, that could benefit from, you know, learning like I was able to learn from going to some of these sessions. And then that's exactly what led me to want to be a part of the review process, so that way I can also hear from community members myself and also learn from them as well, you know, what they're dealing with and how it would help them to be more knowledgeable in this field as well. So the information that I started to learn, you know, it was just like, wow, you know, I see that how many people are infected just by the way, you know, it impacts them financially, by their health. We've seen how it just impacts communities, members, just if they're not able to stay in the same neighborhoods growing up and things like that as well. So we gained a lot of information from the community. And so I just think some of the work that Zero Cities is doing with the PAR team is very important because, you know, for people like me that really didn't, you know, have a clue or pay attention to it because it was not something that affected me, I felt like, every day. But now that I kind of see this, now I know that it does in more ways than, you know. And so I just want, not only for other community members, but for a lot of the youngsters that we're working with that we're hoping to, you know, train up for the opportunities to be in the clean energy sector, that, you know, this work continues to go so that way they can be more informed about these things as well.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor Ted Wheeler, commissioners. I just wanted to highlight some of my personal experiences on the PAR team. I joined the team as a OPAL fellow, and as you guys may know, I'm now the climate justice organizer at Verde. But back then, you're not really having the engaged or being as engaged in the these processes as I am now. It was just super powerful seeing all these black and brown leaders and folks really making efforts to self-determine what we want to see in our communities and how we want to get there. And it personally inspired me to do more. And I also, like, even in speaking with folks that I am friends with who were at the forum, who were engaged in the process, they left with feeling inspired as well. And also, even some of them more engaged in their community and in the processes that go, you know, related to what we did in December. And it certainly gave me the comfortability to at least start to maybe build a trust in our government, in our city, and especially with seeing everything go through. I think that would certainly do the same for our community. I even heard some of that, those comments come from community members participating in the process. And I think a hope like that is just invaluable. And having ownership of the data and the process, and this is the first project I've seen in Portland that has had some real, like, consistent community participation, the decision making, and the really the nuts and bolts of making this work. And we know that community members aren't this consistent in the regular planning and work of the city. So this was just really important to me, and I know other folks. And being, a brown, indigenous, a youth, an immigrant, previously houseless and low income, it is something that I feel like is a really good step. And I like, this is something I want to see, and I want to see followed through. And I thank you for the consideration.
Thank you for being here. We really appreciate it. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor Willey, Commissioner Hardesty, Commissioner Udaley. I'm happy to be here today. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to present. I decided to work on the PAR team because I enjoy engaging with community. I enjoy getting my training and learning new things and knowing what's going on in my city and zone. I think that it's important to have these kind of opportunities for folks that are leaders in our community. I am an alumni of Berlin African American Leadership Forum, and I graduated that program. And I feel like PAR gave me a good opportunity to be able to use my leadership skills. We learned a lot of things that we talked about today in depth. We sat down and we were able to ask questions and really change the scope of the work. So there were things that came up and we said, well, that's not equitable, or that doesn't work for us. And from one side of the table, you'd understand how that's harmful to communities, or what's the issue with this idea. And we were able to put that out there and see immediate action from the team to say, okay, well, we understand what that is, and we'll fix it in this way. And so that was very encouraging to be on part of a process where you as a community member was being heard. I really appreciate the PAR team for compensation. I feel like a lot of the times you go to places and they'll tell you, oh, your community is poor and you're oppressed. Come volunteer, we'll teach you something and give you the opportunity to spread the word. And I said, well, why do you keep telling me I'm poor and you keep keeping me in a poor box? Volunteering is great. I love to donate. I love to volunteer. But I also need to get paid. We are in a very expensive city, and I got children and boys in college. And so if you ever know anything about that, you know that we need money. And so I appreciate that up front, it was saying that we're not going to leave you here to volunteer, and we're just going to feed you and teach you and have you pass on this information. So I think that's a very important part of the process that should be implemented in more of our trainings and processes where we engage community. Because if we have to pay money to do things, we should get paid money to do things. So the Climate Action Process program is something that I hadn't heard of before I was invited to this table. I was very skeptical at first, just because I've been at a lot of tables where we talk about anti-displacement and diversity and equity and making changes around our city and making policy and building and all these things. And so I love that kind of work. And so it was concerning to me to say, like, you have this whole plan to do this work, and I never heard of it when I've been at the table. It's my hashtag, I'm at the table. And so, as we learned about the process and learned how it would be a benefit to our community, a benefit to our environment. I sit on Environmental Justice Council for Portland African American Leadership Forum, and the environment is something that I look at all the time, especially since we had the environmental crisis. So I was happy to be able to learn this information and then take those skills that we learned at that table and directly engage our own communities. There was a point in our training where we did have to decide what kind of space we wanted to present to. And we did decide that we want to have a black and brown space so that folks feel safe to be able to speak their lived experience and not have the contrary or be doubted. And so we had an opportunity to have a forum there. For a bottom line, I think that I would like you to know that we have a lot of people that are ready to lead in our city. We have a lot of people that are ready to learn in our city, and once they learn, they do take action. Being on the other side of this process and engaging with the community often, I've had people come up to me and explain that this process was very helpful. It opened their eyes to situations around energy and our climate issues.
So I'm super sorry.
Okay.
We're going to lose our closed captioning at 3:30. So I just want to do it. We cannot continue without closed captioning.
Okay.
So I just want to be mindful of that, make sure we hear from everybody on the panel and get Andrea's question. We have to cast a vote. Thank you. I'm sorry about that.
That was my wrap-up.
I was just informed about
that. I was bringing it home.
You're doing a great job.
Put it off. I mean, I wouldn't even do that.
Yes. I want to say,
a lot of anticipation.
Yeah, only just... like, we have a community that's ready to lead, they're ready to learn. Let's keep that work going and support this kind of work because it is taking the front line on engaging civic engagement.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
Your comments. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Taryn Evans. I'm with the Coalition of Communities of Color. We are an alliance of 19 culturally specific community-based organizations throughout the Portland metro region. So on this project, CCC worked alongside four member and ally organizations, so Verde, Apano, PALF, and OPAL Environmental Justice. Collectively, our organizations represent diverse communities throughout the city of Portland and communities that stand on the front lines of the climate crisis. Some of the core principles of CCC's environmental justice work are that any environmental or climate initiative must lead with racial and economic equity, prevent harm, provide benefit, and ensure inclusive and accountable decision-making. So this includes equitable policy development through involvement and leadership of the most impacted communities. The Zero Cities Initiative provides a concrete example of these principles put into action and presents a new model for engagement moving forward that truly centers community. The Zero Cities Initiative is a community-led project with the goal of deepening skills and knowledge related to buildings and energy in communities and tapping into the value of community knowledge and lived experience to guide policy. The project centers racial equity and provides an opportunity for those most impacted to chart the path forward and develop solutions that reflect community concerns and priorities. We know that low-income communities and communities of color are most impacted by the effects of climate change, and it is integral as we look for ways to reduce carbon emissions that we elevate these voices and really root our work in community. So we at CCC look forward to continuing to engage in the Zero Cities Initiative. As Vin mentioned, one of the topics that emerged from the community forum was specifically in relation to building performance standard. So we're excited to continue to work with community to explore this topic and generate viable solutions that really have community at the forefront.
Awesome. Thank you. We appreciate it. Thanks all for it.
Thank you.
And Director Durbin, I think the commissioner had one question about how this Zero Cities Initiative fits into our climate action goals and other efforts.
Yes, and thank you very much for your generosity of time this afternoon. Just quickly, briefly, this Zero Cities project is a great example of the kind of shift we want to make in our climate policy action. You will see in our budget request, we've made a modest request to add capacity to one new FTE and some consulting capacity to implement ideas like the building performance standard, which is the idea that's coming out of Zero Cities. You'll also see in the climate emergency resolution draft, be it resolved, section 14 and 15 both make references to this kind of work around buildings and making sure that we're centering it on delivering benefits for frontline communities.
I think we're going to have to continue this conversation. It looks like we got 2 minutes left. the two cities that have already done this do not have a taking law on the book. So if we were to mandate that these changes happen, we'd be sued by building owners that would say that we are taking their property because we're mandating that they do something. So I think we need to check before we try to move that forward as a policy.
Absolutely. And so we will be working closely on policy development with the city attorneys. Absolutely.
Thank you. And then the second thing, how does this fit into the climate emergency resolution that's coming soon?
Yes, so in the climate emergency resolution in sections, be it resolved sections 14 and 15, there are references to doing establishing building performance standards and doing this work and making sure that we're centering frontline communities and impacts for frontline communities. So that really captures the work that we're hoping to move forward. And if Commissioner, if you're interested in augmenting that language, obviously it's a draft resolution right now.
I'm happy to talk to you about that because I'm just concerned if we are that narrowly focused and we can't do it legally without being sued by every owner of a building in the city of Portland.
We have been working with city attorney. We think there is a pathway forward. We're happy to talk to you more about
that. Excellent. Thank you.
Very good. I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second.
I have a motion from Commissioner Hardesty, a second from Commissioner Udaly. Please call the roll.
Hardesty?
If we had more time, I'd have a much more elaborate statement. Let me just say I appreciate the work that you've all done. I look forward to continuing the dialogue, but don't forget that there are people that have to vote for it and people that have to allocate money, and we should be involved so that we know what the heck we're doing. Aye.
Udaly.
Well, thank you to the presenters and invited guests today. I know if Anjanette likes it, it must be good because she is not shy about criticizing the city, and she shouldn't be. I really like the focus on action. I've also been kind of a disillusioned stakeholder as a renter or a parent of a kid with a disability, and you get invited to these tables over and over again, and then you see all your hard work come to nothing or even turn into something that was the opposite of what you intended. So I just want to appreciate that. And I also want to appreciate the priority of repairing broken trust with the community. We can't start at what we think is the best thing moving forward without repairing that trust. And I don't think that we've put enough time or effort into doing that. So thank you. And I vote aye.
Wheeler.
Great report, great presentation, thought provoking. Conversation. I really appreciate everybody sticking around, and you brought it home beautifully. Thank you all. I'm very happy to vote aye. The report's accepted. We are adjourned.